Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther.
And Bob, we're so glad that you're able to fill in as a guest co-host today for Dr. Page. And on our show today, we're actually going to be talking with Dr. Amy Denham, Associate Professor at the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, about all-inclusive care for the elderly, something I know that you care about, Bob.
Yeah, I'm sort of a geriatric groupie because my wife is involved in geriatric topics, and you've had her on this conversation before.
Yeah, well, we'll look forward to that. But we first have some research that matters about, can you design roads to make them safer, and what would that be like? About taking pills to prevent HIV exposure among gay men on a daily basis among men who don't have HIV. About flavored booze beverages. And finally, about fluoridation in the water supply. A lot of public health sorts of issues.
Good. That's what turns us all on.
Let's talk about our very first research that matters, Bob.
So this is an article that published a couple of different studies that were designed to see if road signs and perceptions of drivers that active things were going on in their environment were going to help them become better drivers.
And this was research that was published in the Journal of Consumer Research about a kind of an experiment to test out if, like, things that you can do to make you more hyper-vigilant as you're driving, does that make it more likely that you're going to perhaps drive better and have less accidents?
So some of the things they did were, like, have a rock actually falling off of a cliff onto a road, or
a sign of a rock falling off, not the actual rock.
Right. Or a sign of a car slipping back and forward, or a horse that was galloping as opposed to just standing there. And if they're geared to make human beings more concerned about their environment and therefore hopefully be better drivers.
Right. So for instance, we see a sign that says deer crossing. We think, oh, sure. But we see a sign that looks like it's in motion, that deer are crossing. We're going to probably slow down and watch for the deer. And we know that that's a major cause of death and disability for people getting hit by deers in their cars.
Yeah. So the first study that was alluded to just basically said this worked. And the second one was kind of sophisticated. There were a couple of different versions of it to see if they could measure things like eye movements and time to put on the brakes and that sort of thing to see if people actually improved. And guess what? They did. One theory about this that I thought was pretty cool was, you know, humans are sort of programmed to look out in their environment for things like saber-toothed tigers or wolves are going to attack them. And so they're always vigilant. And if they see something in their environment that makes them anxious, they tend to be more careful.
Yeah, and I think that one of the take-home messages for our teenagers and even for ourselves as we're learning to drive and drive more is to remain hypervigilant. Don't take it for granted because the things that happen, happen quickly. And how we teach that, but in environmentally produced environments that are more in tune to that. Really good research. What's right about our next research that matters, Bob, about HIV disease?
So this was a test of a drug called Truvada, which is a combination of something called tenofovir and emtricitabine.
Big words.
Yes, big words. But basically what it is drugs that affect HIV virus, and hopefully this is going to be used to keep people from acquiring HIV. And and what we find is that there has been one dose given daily, which has had an 86% reduction in transmission of HIV in sexually active gay men.
If they're taking this pill daily and assuming that they're having unprotected sex, because they were having protected sex, they wouldn't have gotten infected to start with, correct?
Or maybe something went awry with their protection method, but this was going to further reduce the chance.
And it's highly effective.
It is. 86% reduction is pretty good. Now, they decided, well, why don't we test it taken one just around the time when somebody anticipates having a sexual encounter, and they took a pill 24 hours in advance, another one 24 hours after the encounter, and another one 48 hours later, and they wanted to see if that would improve things. And guess what? Same result, 86% improvement.
Yeah, the problem I see with that particular second regimen, Bob, is that, you know, a lot of people may not you know, have the pills right on hand like they do in a clinical trial to take it, you know, right before they have sex and then remember to take it afterwards. And so even though the best of intentions, I think the results we would find in practice are different. And I would hypothesize that that once-a-day pill is likely to be far more effective, particularly for those who are having sex many times a week. They would end up taking far more pills than they would just once a day.
Which is exactly what the study showed, that they took more. And if one a day will do the trick, why spend extra money to do it, you know?
Yep, more side effects potentially. Interesting research. Well, this next one is one that is near and dear as of a father of teenagers, which is about the relationship between flavored alcohol and higher injury risk for teens in the American Journal of Public Health.
And it studies some things that were going on in Great Britain and also in the United States, where manufacturers of alcohol were putting sugared beverages and flavors into the mixes with alcohol and seeing if they could increase sales, which they did. And people that drank this way were polled and showed to have way higher rates of accidents. And so the press got all over it in Great Britain and took down the spike in sales that they'd had. And it's been difficult for them to recover from that, which is fine with me.
Yeah. In this particular study, they had 1,000 teens ages 13 to 20 and young adults, and an online survey looked at their drinking habits, and they found that those who drank these very large versions of these flavored alcohol beverages, as you said, six times as likely for alcohol-related injuries than if they didn't consume them. This suggests to me that this is not just an issue of preference. It's an issue of public health, and that's why it's published in the American Journal of Public Health.
I agree.
Well, I don't think we'll have a lot of disagreement about that. What about our very last research that matters about the fluoridation fluoride in our water supply?
Well, this was another British study that found a correlation between the amount of fluoride in public drinking water and the rise in the incidence of underactive thyroid or so-called hypothyroidism. And they pinned this on fluoridated drinking water, and it was published in a British journal.
Yeah, the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. Sounds very official.
But one of the representatives of the American Dental Association took issue with this British report and said, look, this simply drops caries, lowers cavities, makes better dental health, and we don't need to do anything about it in the United States.
Yeah, you know, this is really interesting because hypothyroidism or a low-functioning thyroid is a huge issue in clinical practice. I would guess that, Bob, between you and I, we have seen hundreds and hundreds of patients with it. I don't typically think about the fluoridation of the water supply, but I do think for those patients who would like to lower the risk, if there's a strong family history of thyroid disease, it would make sense to use non-fluoridated water.
And we have a lot of exposure to fluoride, the water, some toothpaste that we do, some swishes that people put in their mouths to try to improve their gums and improve their caries. So it probably is worthy of a study to find out if we have the same problem the Brits proved.
Yep. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We've had a good chance to talk about maybe being hyper-vigilant to be less accident on the road.
Stop using flavored alcohol in our country because it leads to increased accidents and death among teenagers.
Increase use of this medicine Truvada, 86% reduction in HIV transition among those who are very high risk. Pretty impressive.
Yeah, and then the roads, we need to have safer signs on the roads.
Absolutely. Well, when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Amy Denham, Associate Professor of the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, about all-inclusive care for the elderly. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Today on Conversations, Bob, we have the great privilege of talking with one of our colleagues, Dr. Amy Denham, Associate Professor of the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, about all-inclusive care for the elderly.
Welcome, Dr. Denham. Thank you for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Amy, we've known each other for a good long time through your paths. I've watched you go through fellowships, and I've watched you go through clinical environments and with a commitment to care for underserved populations in the health department. Tell us a little bit about how your path, what got you really interested in both family medicine and then kind of moving into this path towards a strong interest in geriatric care?
Yeah, so I think when I started medical school, I came in knowing that I was interested in caring for underserved populations, and that was really the reason that I went into medicine. So for the first part of my career, I was in a local public health department for about 10 years. I was taking care of primarily uninsured population, doing a lot of women's health, child health, family planning, and really enjoyed that work. I think one of the things that that I love about family medicine is that there's a very broad scope of practice. And so if your interest is drawn in a different direction, there's a lot to do with that. So as I got older and as my own parents were getting older and needing geriatric care, I think I began to find that part of my practice more and more compelling. And so I decided to pursue some additional training in geriatric medicine. And as I went through my geriatric training and wanted to maintain the focus on care of underserved populations, I began looking at sort of settings of care that were doing geriatric care well for low-income populations. I think there's a great care infrastructure for older folks with high incomes, but maybe a little less going on for individuals with low income. So that's where I discovered programs of all-inclusive care for the elderly, which is where my current practice is.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about what are the benefits of that for people?
What are the benefits of?
Of the all-inclusive care programs.
And why is it more difficult for a low income? Because I can imagine all of my relatives out there going, it's a problem for all of us.
Yeah, so I think care for older people is expensive. It takes a lot of resources. People, as they get older, tend to accumulate a lot of medical illnesses, chronic diseases, and also began to have a lot of functional impairments, less able to prepare their own food, drive themselves places, get themselves dressed or bathed. And it's really those functional impairments as folks get older that get so expensive in the later years because it requires, in many cases, if there's not a family member available, it requires paying someone to help out with personal care needs. Sometimes that means custodial care, a nursing home or assisted living facility. And so I think for folks with high incomes who can pay for that out of pocket, you can pay for the sort of facility, for the sort of staff that you need. For folks with lower incomes, it can be a lot harder to pull those resources together.
Can you think of an example of someone maybe that you've a situation that you've encountered in the recent past that maybe illustrates some of these things? Give us a sense of what you're really dealing with and facing.
Yeah. So, to give a little bit of background on what a program of all-inclusive care for the elderly or a PACE program is, to give a little context of the kind of patients I see. What a PACE is it's basically centered around an adult day health center, but has clinical services and rehab on site. So to be eligible to be a participant in a PACE program, you have to be 55 years old or older, and you need to basically be able to be certified by the state to need nursing home care, which in North Carolina generally means that you're dependent in two or more activities of daily living, so dressing, bathing, that sort of thing. And you need to be able to live safely in the community with supports. And so really the mission of PACE is to, for people who would otherwise be eligible to live in a nursing home but who want to continue living at home, to provide enough supports to help someone keep living in the community.
So we think about dementia. Is this like most people that have dementia or people who've had a stroke or people who have congestive heart failure? Again, what's the type of, not typical, but what's, you know—
So about half of our participants have dementia, and that's comparable to PACE programs nationally. And the others all have some sort of functional impairments. Often that's due to a stroke. Sometimes it's due to physically disabling conditions such as arthritis. But all of the folks with us have some reason why they're not able to take care of themselves on their own, but with some additional support, with a daycare center they can come to during the day, with some rehab services, we also have social work support, nursing, dietitian, on-site transportation. With some of that support, they can continue living in the community.
So I'm hearing that it's a real medical model, but they're spending all day there. So are there social things that they can do too?
Yeah. Yeah. So we serve lunch. And then there
Bob
are...
Bob and I are going to come, by the way.
So you're welcome to come visit. I don't think you're either of you eligible to enroll in the program. So there's a lot of activities going on. So bingo is popular. There's various sort of craft activities. There's also a lot of sort of self-directed activities. If someone wants to work a puzzle or read the newspaper, or there's a group of men that play dominoes every day, those sorts of activities are going on there. So the people who come to the program have socialization, have activities, but they also have, there's a rehab clinic there on site. So we have a full-time physical therapist, occupational therapist, and a rehab aide who both do some individual rehab, but also do some exercise classes, help people on individual exercise programs. And then we have a clinic. So I tend not to have a regular clinic schedule because everybody's there all day. I just, as I'm ready to see folks and they're there anyway in the center, I can bring them back and take care of whatever medical need they have that needs to be addressed.
And is there a doctor on board all the time there?
Yeah. So at our site, we have a physician, myself, there 3 days a week, and then there's two full-time nurse practitioners that I supervise, and so I'm available by phone the other 2 days a week. And we are in the process of bringing on a new full-time physician.
And would you find this similar arrangement in many states around the country so that this is now a national model? And if it is, what pushed it here and who's paying for it? Because this sounds ideal, but it also sounds expensive.
Great question. Yeah, so it is a national model. And so there are currently, I believe, a little over 100 PACE sites across the country. The model started in San Francisco in the 1970s. There was a program called the Onlock Community Center, which was primarily in the Chinese immigrant community. And this model appeared to be working so well that it was recognized by Medicare and Medicaid and now is a national funding model that if you want to run a PACE program, you can apply to Medicare and Medicaid to set up a site. And the way that we're paid is capitated through Medicare and Medicaid, which basically means for each of our participants, we get paid a flat fee. And then out of that flat fee, we provide for all of the health care needs for that person. So not only primary care services on site, but if someone goes to a hospital, if they need to see a specialist, such as a cardiologist or a neurologist, any health care needs they have comes out of that flat fee that we get paid from Medicare and Medicaid.
We're going to need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to continue talking with our guest, Dr. Amy Denham, Associate Professor of the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, about all-inclusive care for the elderly. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. And we've been talking with Dr. Amy Denham, Associate Professor of the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, about all-inclusive care for the elderly. And Dr. Denham, I know you have some interesting stories. Tell us an interesting story about, you know, what this work is like for you.
Yeah, so there are so many really rich stories that I could share about the participants in our program. I think we take care of a lot of folks living in the community that I think it would be pretty surprising to some of my colleagues can actually thrive at home with the supports we're able to offer. I think of one gentleman in our program who has a neurodegenerative disease, which gives him Parkinson's-like symptoms. And I came into his care in the middle, and so I don't remember all the details, but I believe that he was living in a nursing home prior to enrolling in our program, but really wanted to live at home. This is someone who really is not able to dress himself, bathe himself, even transfer from one surface to another on his own. But he was so motivated to live at home that our program was able to put together supports, home care, someone to come into his home to help get him undressed, get him into bed, and then get him back up in the morning. And he attended our center 5 days a week. And with that socialization, with that support, this is someone who was very isolated, really didn't have much way to interact meaningfully with people around him. But when he came to our program, a very charismatic individual, everybody just came to know him and love him. He's a big UNC fan, so he's always wearing a UNC hat and a shirt, and people are asking him about the basketball games. And he really has formed a lot of meaningful friendships. And his neurologist is a colleague of mine who knew him before he joined our program, who said, I can't believe the difference in this man's life. He was just sort of dwindling away. But now that he has a meaningful place to go to form relationships and support to be able to live at home as opposed to in a nursing home, his life is really so different. His disease has continued to progress, and so he doesn't live alone anymore. He has a family member who has moved in, or I think actually moved him in with them, and so he's needing more help at home, but he does still attend our center and does still get home care that we provide and is still able to get out and have a very full life.
And it also enables the family members to work a job outside of the house while the person is being taken care of in the PACE program.
Yeah. So a lot of caregivers who would not be able to keep someone at home because of their work schedule have somewhere for their loved one to go during the day, and then they're able to provide for their care needs in the evenings.
Earlier in the conversation, we were talking about the physician side of the billing. I'm curious about the finances on the patient side. I gather that if you are either Medicaid or Medicaid and Medicare eligible, that the program is at no cost to you additional. And why Medicaid and Medicare like that is because it's cheaper than paying for it in a hospital. I wonder if you'd share anything else about that. What if you're not Medicaid eligible?
Yeah, so the vast majority of PACE participants do have both Medicare and Medicaid. And that payment that a PACE program receives from Medicare and Medicaid is able to provide for all of the needs for the patient. There is, in some cases, and I don't know all the details of the finances, but in some cases, the patient does have some nominal amount of money that they do need to pay, but the vast majority of it is covered. Many PACE programs do accept folks who don't have Medicaid, but in that case, there would be a fairly large out-of-pocket cost to the person. And so it still would be less expensive than assisted living or nursing home care, but it would be an out-of-pocket cost. And so that tends to be a pretty small proportion of people enrolled in PACE.
What if you have to move across the country? So we're here in North Carolina, but, you know, my sister Alice says, Adam, I really want to help you out here. And mom has always wanted to be on the beach in San Diego in La Jolla. And we're going to move her out here and got the Medicaid and Medicare. Can we move to a PACE program out there?
Well, unfortunately, not all communities have PACE yet, but it is a growing model. And so there are a lot of programs across the country in process of coming online. There is a National PACE Association website, which is npaonline.org, which actually has a PACE finder that you can go to that website and put in your zip code or the zip code of your family member and find out if there is a PACE program available in that location.
We can post that on our website without a problem.
I understand that PACE not only has programs for the patients, but also members of their family. Could you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, so a lot of the services that we provide really are for the whole family. We do provide some caregiver support groups, and really just the support that we provide in the care of the PACE participant is for the family as much as for the participant, because it relieves a lot of the burdens of caregiving. So I'm not sure if there's something specific you're referring to there, but we do our family member caregivers are very involved in the care of our patients. I, on a daily basis, probably talk on the phone or meet with several adult children, spouses, various family caregivers.
You do transportation. So if one spouse doesn't drive but they're trying to help out the other spouse, you might be able to help with transportation, mm-hmm. things like that. So I have a question for you. Thinking back on this transition from this career as this idealistic, incredible taking care of the underserved in the health department setting, which we would call, you know, holy work, many of us who care for underserved populations because of what a wonderful job. And now moving on to care for elderly that are underserved. What's been the greatest, the memory and the greatest both challenge and the greatest pleasure that you're derived thus far?
Well, I think the work being a clinician in geriatrics and specifically in a PACE is hard work. It is high intensity work. These are to get into a program like this. You're medically complex. You have a lot of social needs. You are likely to have had a low income, which often means a lot of sort of barriers and challenges throughout life. So I think there is it's high intensity work, and in that way, it's also really rewarding to help ease the transition through difficult situations for a lot of patients. I think one of the most rewarding things about my current work situation is really working as part of an interdisciplinary team that, more so than anywhere I've ever worked before, I have a whole team of a social worker, a physical therapist, an occupational therapist, a dietitian, a nurse care manager, a transportation coordinator, all sort of sitting around the table every day talking about the care of patients. And so I have an enormous amount of resources to help me through some of the difficult situations that come up with patients. And so I think it's incredibly rewarding to work with a difficult, sick, complex population, but really feel like I have the resources to do that well.
Are there any take-home messages you would like to leave our audience about the PACE program?
Well, I think it is a growing model and an innovative model that I think for families who really are struggling with caring for their loved ones at home and need some extra support, I think it's a great model to investigate. So I heard you mention that you would post the National PACE Association website online. I think it's a great thing to take a look at and consider whether it could help someone you love.
You know, Dr. Denham, we've been colleagues for a long time, and I, on behalf of your health and our listeners, I must say that we're really proud of the work that you're doing here and educating us and all of our listeners about this option for care, this all-inclusive care, this team-based care, what I would say a compassionate care, and one that we all want for our loved ones and for ourselves as we get older. So thank you. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure
Thanks
to talk with you both.
Coming to us, Dr. Denham.
We've been talking with Dr. Amy Denham, Associate Professor at the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, about all-inclusive care for the elderly. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Wyther. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health for the House Calls segment of our show today, Bob. We're going to spend a few minutes taking your health questions and your health concerns.
If you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Nouri, to read us the very first House Call question.
I see flavored e-cigarettes in the drugstore, which I think should be banned, just like CVS has done. This sounds as though the product is being pushed to children and to teens. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, Bob, we've been getting increased questions about electronic cigarettes. I think recently we had one about the advertising of electronic cigarettes, and we had one about kind of use. And even earlier today on the Research That Matters, we talked about flavored alcohol products. The problem with electronic cigarettes is there are hundreds and hundreds of flavors and all types of ways that are enticing to young children and adults. And the majority of the electronic cigarettes that are being used are flavored products.
As an addiction specialist, I think the problem is that we're trying to get nicotine into people to get them hooked so that they're going to continue to do this vaping.
Yeah, well, certainly with those who have never used electronic cigarettes and have never used cigarettes, the introduction into this market through these products is insidious. And we do know that regular flavors in tobacco products were banned by Congress because of their link to increased consumption, particularly among teens. And so I think increasingly there's going to be pressure to eliminate, if not ban, flavored products like electronic cigarettes or even little cigars and cigarillos.
I agree. And I think they should be, because I see no reason why we ought to try to facilitate addiction of anybody to anything. And that's certainly what this is about.
Yeah, we certainly don't need candy, electronic cigarette flavors, and fruit flavors that would mask the fact that these products contain nicotine, which is a potentially addictive substance. Erica, what's our very next house call?
Almost all people complain of the cost associated with going to the doctor, but there is sometimes a bigger cost with not going. I recently went to my doctor after experiencing chest pains while exercising. My doctor promptly sent me to a cardiologist for a stress test, which resulted in a heart catheterization. The results were not good. I had four vessels blocked and had to have surgery 2 days later. 2 weeks after my initial visit to my doctor, I returned for a post-operative care. I cannot say thank you loudly or often enough to my primary care doctor.
Well, on behalf of your primary care doctor, thank you very much. And we're delighted that you managed to do this without having a heart attack. And that's a super outcome.
Yeah, this is really an amazing story. I mean, when we think about, I mean, Bob, when we trained umpteen years ago, it would be 2 to 3 weeks in the hospital alone. And here, from the time to the doctor worried about something happening to the time you're back in the doctor post-operative is only 2 weeks. Amazing.
Yeah, it really is amazing. And so I'm glad that happened. I want to say that not everybody that has chest pain has this situation, but when you find this one and you can do something about it, that's real evidence of progress in medicine and during my career.
And we don't know if this person is a woman or a man, but we do know that heart disease in women presents sometimes differently, and it may be more difficult. So again, kudos to your doctor here for having the suspicion and, you know, getting this started here. We shouldn't discount chest pain, and we shouldn't overreact. But in this particular case, everything worked right, and this was a great aspect here. So if you're sitting there with chest pain, we encourage you at least to start by going to see your primary care doctor.
And not everybody's going to get a recommendation for a stress test or a catheterization, because there's lots of reasons for chest pain that don't happen to be heart-related.
Erica, what's our very next house call?
My uncle has prostate cancer and had treatment. He later developed stricture, which left him having difficulty urinating. How common is this, and can it be treated?
Well, thankfully, it's probably not that common, although I can't say specifically what a incidence of it is. And there's a couple of reasons why it can happen. It can be an outcome of an actual surgical procedure or subsequent radiation he may have had. In either case, it can be treated, generally by doing another surgery to try to open up the stricture.
Yeah, and we should define what a stricture is, which is just a narrowing of that little tube called the urethra where the urine comes out. And it's like a hose that begins to narrow and narrow, or a drain that gets more clogged. You can't force things through it, including urine, and it begins to back up. And there's all kinds of – what would be some of the common symptoms that someone with a stricture would have, Bob?
Well, definite decreased urinary flow, perhaps more increase in the frequency of urination so that somebody's bladder tries to squeeze through and then finally gives up and doesn't manage to get enough. And it just makes frequency of urination, urgency to get there, very much a symptom.
One of the things that makes this a little bit more difficult with people who present with the stricture is it's not like the person comes in and says to the doctor, oh, I have a stricture. And so we have someone who's urinating a little more frequently, and we may check the urine, and it may be negative, and we might think, oh, everything's normal. So one of the take-home points here is someone diagnosed a stricture. They did a really good job. And it's not necessarily the first thing a doctor will think about. So if things don't seem right, they usually aren't.
Right. And this was probably diagnosed post-op. And there are flow rates that you can determine, which takes a little calculating and a little instrumentation to pull off. And they could probably see that, too.
But once it's treated, which involves kind of dilating it up, making it larger, then the urinary flow rates become really quite good. So this is a kind of a win-win. Get the diagnosis. It can get better. And we hope your prostate cancer is undergoing successful treatment. Erica, what's our very last house call?
My husband has dementia that is slowly getting worse. I'm not willing to put him in a nursing home, but it's definitely taking a toll on me. What are our options?
You know, Bob, I know that you have a lot of experience because of Lisa. Bob's wife is one of the great experts in dementia care and Alzheimer's care for the state of North Carolina. What are your thoughts here?
Well, this comes down to a noble ambition not to put somebody out of their house or to put them in an environment that they may consider unpleasant. But then what happens is that the wife is going to become the caregiver, which is its own stressful job. And there are a lot of people that do a wonderful job of caregiving, and the toll on their health is real beyond that. So what I would say is this, that's a noble ambition. You might want to find out more about what you're getting into. There are support groups in the area. There's one my wife runs over at Duke. That's the North Carolina support group. And you can call there or call other people. Go see your primary care physician and find out what resources you have. And I think the experience shows that people who are in these support groups are very helpful at, A, understanding what their comrades are going through, and, B, giving good advice to them to minimize the stress.
Yeah, I think of two things. One is this kind of this advice to help out for the person who has the dementia and kind of like going to these day centers that you can get and have someone take care of your loved one for that day, or then taking care of the person who's taking care of that person in these support groups. And I've also heard of even family caregiver seminars and ongoing issues, because this is, you're in it for the long haul frequently, and that's really, really difficult. And all of us are going to need probably this type of support for some kind of condition in our lives, or we'll be caring for someone who has these kinds of conditions. So we thank you for that question, and we thank all of our listeners today for all of their questions. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to your health. Please share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook. You can search for Your Health for a free download on iTunes or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Amy Denham, and my guest co-host, Dr. Bob Gwaither. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Bob Gwaither.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.